everyone, and welcome to the special Meet the Board series featured once a month on Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast. Each week on Wednesdays, Managed Healthcare Executive features C-Suite healthcare professionals whom we speak with about the most important issues in healthcare. In our Meet the Board series, we spotlight a member of MHE's editorial advisory board so our listeners know more about our board members and their roles in healthcare. The Meet the Board series is broadcasted at the end of every month, so be sure when you tune in to listen in and learn a lot. Hi everyone, my name is Brianna Contreras and I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. In this episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite, listeners are tuning into our next feature of the Meet the Board series where Senior Editor Peter Werwein of MHE and I speak with Board Member Don Hall, who is Principal of Delta Sigma LLC. Delta Sigma is a consulting practice specializing in strategic problem solving for managed care organizations. In addition to being a loyal member of our board since 2007, Don most recently served as president and CEO of a nonprofit provider-sponsored health plan. In this conversation, you'll learn a bit about Don personally and his thoughts about the current issues healthcare is facing today.
All right. So first, can you tell us about yourself? Maybe how you chose your profession, more about your consulting business, and maybe how long you've been a member on MHE's board.
Sure. Let me start with the last question first. I think I became a member of the board of Managed Healthcare Executive in 2007. So I've been with the publication for quite a while and seen a lot of changes and seen a lot of growth. My career, I started out with a Master of Public Health in epidemiology and worked in the public health sector for a while in maternal and child health. I was recruited to a nonprofit hospital, and I think my background is like many of the executives that read your publication. None of us ever started out and said, oh, I'm going to be a president of a health plan. That's what I'm going to do. So my career is really an evolution. I was recruited to a nonprofit hospital that focused on cardiology and oncology, and I got involved in preventative care there, and then that hospital was purchased by Hospital Corporation of America, so I went into the for-profit sector. They merged with Equitable Informed, a managed healthcare organization called EquiCor, and I got recruited into that, and I've moved around with acquisitions and divestitures of healthcare. I ended up at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, responsible for market and product development, and then ended up in Colorado where I was president of a company called Colorado Access that focused on Medicare, Medicaid, children's health plan, prison populations, and so on. And then I left about 14 years ago to form my own consulting practice. Over the course of all of those different positions, I found that there were certain things I really got excited about, but managing on a day-to-day basis was not one of them. And so I have a partner, Sherry Rolfing, and the two of us basically have been running the organization for 14 years. And our primary focus is on business strategy and helping managed healthcare companies identify pain points. And by pain points, it could be something like, where are they losing money? Where should they be looking at growth opportunities? You know, what is likely to cause them to have problems in the future? And we try to integrate that with sort of scenario planning and contingency planning. I mean, what could hit them? And one of the scenarios we've actually worked with our clients on in the past has been, what if there was an epidemic? What if there was this huge wave of disease that totally changed everything? And so it's been kind of interesting to see that, you know, that's where we're at.
This is Peter Werwein. Don, if you've been advising people about how to prepare for a pandemic, have you seen a gap between what you were telling people to do to prepare and how this pandemic has played out? Were you advising them about PPE or the disappearance of the in-person visit being replaced by telehealth, and some of these big changes that we've seen that have been driven by COVID-19?
Well, yeah, it is interesting. I mean, some of the things that we were talking about was, number one, being able to quickly move to a virtual workforce, that you weren't going to be able to get everybody together. The other was that you were going to have to really move to virtual healthcare. As much as possible, you were going to have people meet with providers, you know, discuss their symptoms, get treatment as remotely as possible. And the third thing was that it was going to have to be extremely easy for people to get their symptoms checked, for diagnosis to be made, and if there was treatment or whatever, that would all be part of a package. And I think one of the pieces that I did for Managed Healthcare Executive, we talked about plans should just cover all of that. There should not be anybody who says, I don't have the $25 to go to provider. I'm just going to have to stay here and hope it's not, you know, a communicable disease. So those are the kinds of things we were looking at. We did not foresee the pandemic raging as quickly as this one has. I mean, I'm sure we'll get into it later, but there have been some extremely big balls dropped very early on how this pandemic has been managed in this country versus other countries.
So is the adoption of telehealth and remote care, I mean, it's been talked about a lot how quickly it's happened. Have you been surprised at the pace? And most people identify the loosening of the CMS restrictions on telehealth as being perhaps the biggest driver. Do you see it that way? It's just taken off. It's stunning.
It is. And well, you know, it's interesting. We actually started working with a large telehealth company, probably 10 years ago. And we could see it coming. It was simply the consumer adoption of that platform, and also health plans recognizing the value of it. And so I do think CMS was a key driver. But before that, health plans were actually doing a lot more work to try to get virtual health adopted. It just wasn't that, I think it, there wasn't that much interest on the part of a lot of consumers to do that. And so I think this really kind of crossed that watershed. But it's interesting because all of the pieces were in place to make it happen immediately if it needed to. You had companies like Teladoc who had huge networks of providers that could immediately go online. You know, they could do the record work, they could do the either virtual on the phone or whatever. And so it was really a matter of just the right timing to make it happen. And I think health plans jumping on it, CMS jumping on it, just facilitated. I think the great thing is that consumer adoption of it is so good that I think when we talk about the new normal, virtual healthcare is not going to go away. And the impact on rural health is tremendous. The impact on behavioral health is tremendous. To be able to access behavioral healthcare anywhere in the country virtually is huge. And so I think there have been some great outcomes from it. But I think it was just waiting for the right thing to happen to drive it over. And I think this pandemic was it.
Yeah, it's you know, remarkable in some sense that didn't happen sooner with behavioral health, which of course does involve some prescriptions, but it's a talking transaction. So it lends itself to remote interaction. And geez, by the time you get to the therapist appointment and you get, you know, park and whatnot, for a 45-minute appointment, the time on either side of that was,
right,
you know, you end up with 200% increase in the amount of time, and people didn't show up for appointments and so on. So
there's value, so much value, behavioral health specifically, the ability to record the interaction. So many people, when they have a behavioral health encounter, they're in a very crisis state. And so their ability to hear everything that the therapist is telling them, sometimes they come away and did he say that? Did she say that to me? The ability to go back when they're more calm and hear some things you need to do is enormous. And so I think there's a value. It's greater than just the ability to get it virtually. It's beyond that, I think. And I think it gets behavioral health into areas that never had it. I mean, if you're out in remote Colorado, your ability to have an interaction with a behavioral health provider is very limited.
Now, another thing that's been talked about a lot in the context of COVID-19 and the lasting effects on healthcare, and I don't mean to dismiss, you know, the pandemic is over, but in what sort of structural changes might happen in the healthcare sector, whether the pandemic, that virtual disappearance of medical service, and for entities that depended on fee-for-service, the disappearance of revenue, and the contrast to those entities who were in some sort of value-based care arrangement where there was some capitated payment. Some people I've heard talk think that this is going to accelerate the move away from fee-for-service to capitation arrangements of one type or another, because people have experienced what happens when service disappears as a result of a disruptive event. So do you see it as an accelerant? Do you think, you know, the value, in the same way that we talked about telehealth for a long time, we talked about value-based care, and is this going to be the thing that puts us over the hump?
You know, I do. I actually think that it's going to drive capitation, more value-based capitation, where if I'm a provider, it doesn't matter what's going on in the world. If I've got diabetic patients, there's certain things that those diabetic patients need me to work with them on. And so I should be, you know, I will be held accountable through a capitation agreement to manage that caseload of patients and make sure that they're taking the medication, they're managing their care, doing all the things they need to do. So I do see that happening. I think, you know, one of the deterrents of virtual care prior to the pandemic was, do you pay the same amount to a doctor for a virtual visit as you do for an office visit? And so that kind of got gummed up. And now it doesn't matter. I mean, if I've got patients to be taken care of in my health plan, I'm willing to pay you to take care of them, whether it's for, I don't care. I don't care if you call them. I don't care if your nurse talks to them. I just want to make sure that I'm not going to see them in emergency rooms because they're not getting the care they need for whatever their issues are. So I do think that you're going to see a lot more drive to capitated agreements with requirements for certain delivery of care and certain outcomes.
Right, you sort of need those guardrails on it to keep the quality of care up. So this is maybe a little bit glib, but you know, this is a crisis, and crisis sort of creates winners and losers. We've talked about a couple of winners, quote unquote, namely remote care, telehealth, and maybe value-based care. You know, from a high level perspective, who are going to be the losers here? What are we going to see sort of disappear or attenuate as a result of some of the structural changes to healthcare?
Well, obviously bricks and mortar. I mean, I think bricks and whatever it is, and whatever business, whatever industry you're talking about, bricks and mortar is going to go. I mean, Amazon and other virtual e-tailers are going to dominate. People are going to be uncomfortable going to department stores. I think you're going to see it this Christmas season that people are going to go crazy online. And I think that's not going to go away. And I think in healthcare, we're going to see a whole lot driven to virtual. And I think that there are a lot better minds than mine that are looking at, in virtual visits, what else can we attach to it in terms of instrumentation and devices to monitor hearts, to do the kinds of things that we would normally send somebody into a big clinic to do. And I think the big losers are going to be the bricks and mortar and the people who have, you know, bought land and planned to plant a hospital there or a clinic there. And that's going to go away. I talked to a lady in Texas recently who was at the very final stages before this started of developing clinics for women between the ages of 16 and 24 for women's health outside of pregnancy. And so, you know, she had thought through the kinds of clinics, the areas they would be in, all this stuff, and had already made investments in properties and clinics. Went away. It's all gone. I mean, you can do everything she wanted to do virtually with the caveat that you could do it better. You could bring in the, you know, providers anywhere in the world. You could bring in people that you could not have available to in Texas, talk to people and to look at things. And so I think the biggest loser by far is bricks and mortar.
So kind of just to continue on from that, you know, effects of the pandemic, if you can just share what your sense of where the pandemic is headed and what the response should be. So maybe more in depth, do you favor a national mask mandate? Do you think a 2021 vaccine will bring back or just create a new normal for, I guess, the following year?
Well, I was just reading right before I got in the call, Fauci put out a release that any vaccine will not prevent you from getting the virus, it will relieve you of the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so I think the thought that a vaccine is going to change the world is not going to happen, at least not in the next few years. I don't see a vaccine in the works that's going to eliminate this. And in fact, a lot of people in the World Health Organization think we're going to have to live with COVID from now on. It's going to be there. And so we're just going to have to learn to deal with it. You know, as someone with an epidemiological background, I think what we've got to do, if we're going to get back to any sense of normality, is we have to start from the point of, let's say we start with you, Brianna. We check you, you don't have COVID. Mm-hmm. Then we go out from you and we check everybody out from you. And so we create these big areas of COVID-free populations. And it just continues to grow and grow. And you find people that have it, you isolate them, you treat them, and you go out from there. And we've not been able to do that at all. And frankly, this thing has gotten so big that it's going to be extremely difficult to do that. But we're going to have people who can do the follow-up, who can do the testing. We have to have rapid testing, which is there now. Rapid testing that is available to populations almost immediately, and then start going out and creating COVID-free areas and just keep going. And anybody new coming in gets tested. I think the new normal is being tested. I think, you know, there's saliva tests that was interesting. Amazon now has a saliva test that you can buy for COVID. You take it and a couple of days later, you get the results. But I think what we're gonna see is there's going to be tests that can give you results in 10 minutes. And that's just gonna become a normal to be checked for COVID and to create these areas. I mean, right now they're pods of people, you know, the families that know they're not exposed, but that's got to get bigger. We've got to grow out from that. So I think that's the way we're gonna have to deal with it. The opportunity there is that it's gonna require a significant investment in public health. And I think that's gonna be a big outcome of this. Public health, which has sort of been dwindling and there's not been a lot of money going out for vaccinations and immunizations, that's gonna change. We're gonna see a lot more jobs created and trackers, people who can track and do all the testing and create these open areas that are COVID-free.
So really just kind of creating a new world that's just all wrapped around COVID.
Well, until the disease hopefully runs its course,
right?
Getting negatives and negatives and negatives and negatives. Now, the epidemiologist in me says until the next one, you know, until swine flu, until the next. This woke up the public because it's gotten so big so fast.
Right.
But anybody in infectious disease will tell you that we have a assembly line of diseases coming our way. And I think this is, it's great that the mortality rate has been 2 and 3% in this, that we've been able to do the, that we have to do the things we have to do, because there is going to be something that has the mortality rate of Ebola come. And we have to be prepared at that point to do what we need to do.
Right. And as you said, hopefully more developments will come about to, I guess, spot it sooner or make it easier to, I guess, like you said, treat symptoms, but not simply cure it.
Yeah, I think in the future, you know, when the plane load of people landed and that had COVID, that was so uncontained. I mean, anybody, any epidemiologist said, you know, that's the makings of a horror movie, you know, letting it out. Anything like that would be contained. And I think you're going to see much quicker reaction, much more tracking of disease. It's not like this thing started and just hit us. It was actually being tracked back as early as November of 19. And so it's not like it wasn't being seen. These things are out there. We can watch them. We'll put the money in the infrastructure the World Health Organization needs to have to track every infectious disease coming up anywhere in the world, because it's an interconnected world now.
Right. Okay, now kind of to continue with the pandemic, but also with, you know, protests that have happened, you know, in the last few months, issues with racism and the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, has all of those factors, have they opened your eyes to health disparities in a new way?
Well, social determinants of health is something that we have seen. People who work with the population of people that are covered by Medicaid, Children's Health Plan, have for a long time seen that the significant impact of racism on access to healthcare, racism on the on access to grocery stores and things like that. So it's not a surprise to people who have worked on social determinants of health to recognize that race is a significant factor in people's health interests and people accessing not just healthcare, but people accessing just basic safety. You know, in my neighborhood, if I were to call the police because I hear somebody outside, I'm going to be pretty comfortable that they're going to look around the house, they're going to check things, I'm fine. If I'm Black, you know, I could become the victim of that call, you know, and that's a reality. I have friends that have told me, you know, they tell their kids, put your hands on the steering wheel, you know, don't do anything wrong. Police are looking to stop you. And so I think that's something that, you know, my background in Medicaid, my background in public health, I've seen that for a long time. It's not just the police. Racism is systemic. And I, you know, I'm sorry that as a country, we have a tough time saying that, but it's systemic. And it does mean that in Black areas of town and poor Black areas of town, you don't have grocery stores you don't have that are available. That the way that people get their food is they go to these fast food places where it's cheap and it's high in fat and it's filling. You know, they don't have the sanitation. You know, my area, there's no trash on the streets, but street sweepers come through all the time and clean it. And, you know, trash is taken twice a week and on and on and on. So I think that I hope this opens up the eyes of the healthcare community in a larger way. I think because of what we're seeing with social determinants of health becoming such a big issue, and I'll tell you where that started was really the expansion of Medicaid. The expansion of Medicaid in the states that expanded under the Affordable Care Act, all of a sudden, Medicaid was based on income level, not whether you were pregnant or whether you were woman, or it was based on income level. So all of a sudden you had poor people who didn't have a home, who had things that in their life that we would take for granted. They don't have a car, so they can't get to the hospital. They call an ambulance if they need to go someplace, or they go in for an outpatient procedure at a hospital that'll take them, and they're in for a week because they don't have a place to be discharged to. All of a sudden, health plans that they're starting to get paid for those people, and they go, wait a minute, does it make sense for me to pay for somebody to stay in a hospital for 7 days because they don't have a home to go home to? Maybe I could provide them with a temporary room. Maybe I could make Uber available to them. Maybe I could give them, provide them access to better food. And so I think that really started the whole social determinants. And I know I'm going way too long here, but social determinants of health is an enormous issue in healthcare. And I know you know that it has more of a factor in longevity than it does, than your DNA does. And so it's one of those things that I'm glad to see it getting the attention it did. I really credit the Affordable Care Act expansion, forcing health plans to get into those people who were poor, and how they use the healthcare system result.
This is Peter. That's really fascinating that Medicaid expansion, where you think of coverage as sort of the end result that you're trying to achieve, but actually coverage ends up being a means whereby some root causes are addressed, that once you start changing payment arrangements and who's responsible for the dollar, right, things start to change. So that that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, and you can see it. I mean, even the for-profit Medicaid plans are buying apartments. I mean, it's a natural thing because, and it only works where it's constrained by capitation. If I only get $280 a month to provide health care to you, you can bet that's going to change what I look at versus I get paid every time you do something. I mean, yeah. Under fee-for-service in the states that still have fee-for-service Medicaid, you're not seeing that. You know, states are slow to react to that because the incentives aren't there.
All right. Well, then, for our last and just another personal question, if you can share how COVID has affected your health habits, maybe are you exercising more or less, eating healthier, your sleep and social interaction? How is that, if you'd like to share?
You know, a friend of mine got married and had a baby when he was 40. His wife had a baby. But he told me, he said, you know, Don, I'm thrilled about having the baby, but I hope it doesn't change my life that much because my wife and I like to go out and have dinner. We like to do all these things. And I said, you know, that baby is going to change every single aspect of your life. Now, and I added, but you're going to love it. But COVID has changed every single aspect of my life. I'm in a pod. I have a daughter who's just had a grandbaby. So, you know, we're all very aware of going out. I wear a mask every time I go out. I used to go to the fitness center and I don't get to do that anymore. And there is no way I can replace what I was doing there with enough walking or whatever. And so that's frustrating. And when I go to the grocery store, I'll have to say the dessert section, I go, wow, that would be nice to have coffee and that in the morning instead of my usual oatmeal. So it has affected that in every way. And sleep, you know, with the politics. yeah, sleep is not easy. And social interaction, you know, I'm a huge birder. I'm an Audubon Master birder, so I love to go out and look at birds.
Oh, that's great.
And you know, when you're out with masks on, staying 6 feet away, it's a whole different interaction going out, everybody in their own cars, and you know, it's not environmentally smart anymore. But so yeah, it has.
Okay, well, again, thank you so much for your time, Don.
I wanted to talk about books. You didn't ask me about the book.
Well, please share. I want to know more about the books you're reading.
First, I have to say I'm a huge reader. So COVID has been good for that because, you know, I don't feel guilty about reading instead of doing something else. It's actually good. But a couple of books that I think would be really good for your readers or for your readers. One is that I read earlier this year. It's called Black Death at the Golden Gate by David Randall. And it's about the bubonic plague coming to San Francisco at the turn of the century. And it is an amazing read to see how public health was treated at that time and how politics in the California area really prevented doing what needed to be done to stop the movement of the bubonic plague through the city. It also coupled with the earthquake. And so a lot of what you see in San Francisco right now in terms of their infrastructure, in terms of concrete in a lot of places was a direct result of the bubonic plague and replacing wood with concrete and everything. Another great book that I finished not long ago is called The Great Influenza by John Barry. And it talked about the 1918 influenza, which is not, it was not COVID, but right. it was indeed influenza. But it's a remarkable read about, again, trying to manage this highly infectious disease against the politics at that time of World War I, and also the politics of people not wanting to take it seriously, about the gatherings where they would, you know, people would come together and all of a sudden you'd see a spurt up. Another healthcare book I'm actually just reading right now is called Which Country Has the World's Best Healthcare System by Ezekiel Emanuel. And one of our clients is the Academy of International Health Studies. Perry Cohen is on your board and he runs that. We actually facilitate the executives going overseas. And Peter, I hope you can go with us on one of them. But it looks at all the at a number of countries' healthcare systems and talks about how well they do and which one's the best. And because of the timing of it, it also talks about how that is interplayed with their reaction to COVID. That's a great book too.
I read a review of the manual book where he actually doesn't answer the question in the title.
Yes. Well, and you know, you can see why he says.
It depends on what you mean by best.
It totally depends, yeah. And he really talks about the different systems and how they work. The one clear thing coming out of it is long-term care is going to kick our butts. I mean, no country is anywhere ready to deal with an aging population and what that brings us to.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Apple Podcasts, and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on MHE, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.